So, Rav Kalman Kalman Shapiro, I'm just curious, have we heard of it by like a thumbs up or some thumbs down? Have we heard of this person before? May have heard the story. A thumbs down from Rhoda. Okay. He's also known as the Eish Kodesh. You may have heard of Rabbi Moshe Weinberger's shul, his Eish Kodesh, named after his sefer, although as we see that he never actually wrote a sefer called Eish Kodesh, but that is the most prominent sefer from him, or at least that's the way that it's known. And it's actually somebody I've had in mind to talk about for a long time. Some may have seen on my bookshelf the book Sacred Fire, so Eish Kodesh, right? That's his book, and this is a translation. I mean, all going to be a translation. And right, I see on the front Torah from the Years of Fury, 1939 to 1942. So what is this? So very quickly, what is this? This is his collection of drushos that he gave while in the Warsaw Ghetto. Okay, so he was rabbi in Warsaw. He was known as the Piasecki Rebbe. We'll get into what he had to do with that town, but really he was mostly living in Warsaw. He was living within the confines of the ghetto. I mean, he was already living there before the ghetto wall started going up. And he lived. He was essentially like the Rebbe of the ghetto. He was able to survive a rather long time. We'll get into a brief story history of the ghetto shortly. And he collected his, and every Shabbos he continued to give drashos. It's unclear to me whether that was legal or whether it was illegal. I mean, how clandestine was his efforts? But he gave his drashos.
This is the Warsaw Ghetto.
The Warsaw Ghetto, right. So the Warsaw Ghetto had someplace in the realm of 500,000 Jews in it at its height, and then it got decimated pretty soon. But for about 3 years, there was a very large contingent of Jews. About 500,000 Jews were living in that area. The ghetto itself really, not much happened there for the first couple of years. I think 1940 is when the walls went up, and then I think Jews were collected there actually, I believe in 1940 or so, and continuing later on in 1940s when the walls of the ghetto actually went up, and then another 2 years or so, not much happened. I mean, there were Jews there. There were some that were going into forced labor. There was starvation. There was not enough food to go around. There was not enough supplies to go around. There was disease that was there, but that was it. I mean, it was just Jews that were confined to this area. In summer of 1942 is when the deportations started, being sent to mostly to Treblinka over the course of that summer, and it sounds like someplace in the realm of 450,000 Jews were shipped out over that summer in 1942 and sent to Treblinka. Now, Treblinka was not a concentration camp. There are almost no survivors of Treblinka. It was a death camp. Essentially, you were sent up on a train, about a 2 hour drive from Warsaw to Treblinka. It's in the middle of a forest someplace, and they were taken off a train and they were gassed right away. That happened over the summer of 1942, and then it seemed to stop for a couple of months. Now, the Rav Shapiro was able to stay. He did not get sent away during that time. He sort of survived that. He was part of the, I don't know, 10-20% of people that were not sent away during that time. Stayed in the ghetto for a while. Ultimately, seems like he got sent away, I think, January, February of 1943. And the Warsaw Ghetto uprising began in earnest in April of 1943. Right? That's Pesach and Yom HaShoah in 1943. So that seems like that uprising was after he was sent away, but he was still alive. He was sent away to a place called Tranicki camp. That was some kind of labor camp. Why the Jews? We'll try to get into a little bit of that story later on, but during this whole time, at least from 1940 till 1942, he was giving drushos on Shabbos, and he collected these drushos on Shabbos. Now, presumably, the drushos were given in Yiddish. He wrote down his notes in Hebrew and in rabbinic Hebrew, and he worked on them. And he knew that this was going to be something that was going to be remembered. And as he got towards the end of that time, 1942. He collected all of his writings. stuffed it in a milk container. Now, things are a little more contained than that. If you take a look at the source sheet to give you a little bit more background here. So, actually, my sheet just got printed. Take that back. It didn't really get printed. So we'll just take a look at the source sheet on the page. So if you take a look on the front page, so the top left, looking at it, top left, that is a picture of Rav Shapiro. He was 52. He was born in 1889. So he was in his early 50s. I'm not sure if that picture is dated. So he was in the ghetto. There is this person named Emanuel Ringelbaum. So his picture is right next to him. So he recognized the historical, it's unclear to me whether he was Orthodox or not, but he recognized the historical value of what was going on in the ghetto. He thought that most were not going to survive. Certainly in 1942 or so, it started becoming clear that the plan was not to just keep them away from everybody, but rather that most of the people there were not going to be able to survive. And he collected as much as he could in terms of evidence. So there were things, there were diaries that were kept. There were other things that were kept. And he ran something called the Oneg Shabbos Committee. That was the name somehow. And he collected whatever he could and sort of organized whatever he could and stuffed it into these milk containers. So the middle picture on the page is one of these milk containers. I don't know if it's the milk container that contained the H. Kodesh, but there was several of these containers that were hidden in several different spots. They say that they have found about two-thirds of them. They think that there's a third that has not been found. Not really sure where, it was a city that got... that got destroyed, that got bombed eventually, and things got lost. It's unclear whether it's lost, whether it's just under a building still waiting to be found. But amongst that which was found was his drashos, with the note on top of it. I'm sorry, just to give one more other personality involved. There is this person on the right named Shimon Huberband. Who is he? So he, that is, as you could see, that is his card, his registration card for being in the ghetto, his work card that was probably used for him to come in and out of the ghetto. And he was, seemed like he might have been the person who reached out most to the religious community on behalf of this Emanuel Ringelbaum. So he was close with the Rebbe, with Rav Shapiro. He was the one who was the liaison to bring his notes and ultimately have it packed away with this committee in this, in these milk containers, which were then buried under, in several bunkers, not just in one spot, but in several bunkers in the ghetto, and it was destroyed, and they were found. They were found 7 or 8 years later. It wasn't like right afterwards it was found. 7 or 8 years later, they were excavating the area, and one of the workers came across these things, and he came across the note that is on the left. That left note... that is written in the Rebbe's handwriting, and it's in Yiddish. I cannot really read it, but the English translation is found right underneath. Right, attention, thus Hashem, I have the honor of requesting the esteemed individuals or institutions that finds my writings. Pachsharas Avreichim, Mevo Hasha'arim, Tzav Vizeruz, and Torah Insights on the Weekly Readings for the years 5700, 5701, 5702. Right? So those were his Svarim. Hasharas Avreichim, he wrote some Svarim. And then he also says, and my collection of drashos, which he gave during his time while in the thing. So he didn't give it a name. He just said, these are my drashos. Right? Please exert yourselves to send them to the land of Israel to the following address, Rav Yeshaya Shapiro, Tel Aviv, Palestine. Right? No address, just Tel Aviv, Palestine. Now, Rav Yeshaya Shapiro was his brother. I'm not sure there are any other brothers, but that was his brother. His brother was, they came from a Hasidic Rebbe family. His father was known as, I believe, the Rupschitzer Rav. He himself had very strong Hasidic yichus, traced himself back to Rav Elimelech of Leshensk, which, if you know the Hasidic dynasties, that is considered real royalty. You could still, even at a Yom HaZeh, go visit the kever of Rav Elimelech Meleshensk. It's one of the prominent places that people visit when they go to Poland. And he was of that stock. And he has a brother who became Mizrahi, still, you know, and was actually known as a tzaddik in Eretz Yisrael, in Tel Aviv. So please also send the enclosed letter. When the Blessed One shows mercy and I and the remaining Jews survive the war, please return all materials to me or to the Warsaw Rabbinus for Kolonimus. And may Hashem have mercy on us, the remnant of Israel in every place, and rescue us and sustain us and save us in the blink of an eye. With deep heartfelt gratitude, Kolonimus. So there's a bunch of stuff that is written about this. Why exactly did he sign it Kolonimus? What did he mean by that? But that's what happened. Ultimately, these were collected. It's 1950. It was sent to Rav Shapiro. Somehow it got to Rav Shapiro in Tel Aviv. He was able to organize several Piasetzner Hasidim that were able to survive the war. They published, I believe, in 1960, they published the first edition of what became known as Eish Kodesh. It became known as Eish Kodesh. I mean, they called it Eish Kodesh. That was the title that they granted to it. Now, again, the Rebbe never referred to it in that way. The Rebbe apparently, in other writings, refers to an Eish Kodesh and talks about that as a concept, but that's not really what he is. But that was the title that was given to the Sefer, and that's the way it became known. It's been reprinted several times. And translated several times. One of the translations is here in Sacred Fire, and that is sort of the what is fascinating about it is if you go through it. So your first impression is, I mean, if you would just get this, then it would be called Drushos of Rav Kolonimus Kalman Shapiro. You would read through it, and it would seem like a regular Hasidic work. Like, it goes through parsha by parsha by parsha. Not once does he mention Nazis. Not once does he mention Germans. Not much does he really mention any current events. He does not explicitly refer to anything that is actually happening. I mean, you think if you ever go to the Lam archives of Rabbi Lam's drushos that you could find online. So it's interesting, but you could very clearly connect the dates to events that were happening during that time. And he refers to date events that were happening at the time. He talks about Kennedy's assassination. And he talks about inaugurations and presidents and other news items that are going. In fact, in some ways, it's remarkable how little things have changed in the last 50, 60 years. But the topics still are going. So Rav Shapiro, in his writings, does not explicitly refer to anything that is going on. Meaning, one could just read it and say, "Look at that! He's an interesting vort." Now there is someone named, and I've had in mind a couple of years already to speak about him. But the truth is, I couldn't really get past that. I mean, there wasn't much. I wasn't just through looking around and Googling and things like that. I wasn't really able to find much biographical information beyond really what I've just shared. And then I was like, all right, well, that's not really enough to do an entire profile in persecution. So recently a book came out that I didn't realize a book had come out a couple of years ago that I could have used and actually is entirely online and found it today and probably read through half of it today. But there's a book that came out recently here, Hasidim Suffering and Renewal, an academic book that was put together by Don Seaman, Daniel Reiser, and Ariel Evan Mays. So I'm not sure all these people who they are, but Daniel Reiser, he put together a critical reading of the Eish Kodesh, because if you take a look at the bottom right of the first source sheet, that is what you found when you opened up when you read those drushas, right? So as you can see, it is not easy making heads and tails out of what that writing is. I mean, there's a lot of abbreviations. Meaning, it's not even unclear how Rav Shapiro was able to get the paper to write this on. Paper was not something that they were giving out in the ghetto at all. So somehow he was able to get enough paper, but he wrote, and he also put in many, many corrections and things that are added on to the side. So when the Hasidim published it in 1960, they did the best that they could. They just published whatever they could in order. But what this Daniel Reiser did is then actually analyzed what the Rebbe wrote the first time and then what he wrote when he reviewed it. Because as we mentioned before, the trains started, the deportations from the ghetto happened over the summer of 1942. The drushos in Eish Kodesh, in the book, end also summer of 1942. Now, earlier in 1942, you see there's already a turn that takes place in the drushas. I mean, they start becoming more morose and more more depressing, as we'll talk about. But they really end then. I believe Akev, Parshas Akev of 1942 is the last. Shabbos Chazon 1942 is the last one mentioned, and he wasn't taken away for another 6 months. So he spent those 6 months not rewriting, but editing and working things out, to knowing that he probably wasn't going to survive, or maybe he would, but that this would ultimately be something that would be published, and would be published as a testament to what Jewish life was like in the ghetto, and therefore that's the way that it came together. So that is so that's what we got. So I always sort of wondered, is he the reason that we know about him? Do we know about Rav Shapiro because of this? Meaning, what would happen if the Holocaust would never have happened? Did he have contributions beyond the drushos that we had then, or is it that now he has one major contribution which we know about, which you know most yeshiva bachrim know about, and that is a sefer called Chovas HaTalmidim. So where he sort of sets out what the goal is of a Talmud, of a student while they are learning. It's been translated also Student's Obligation. That's his other very famous work. So I always wondered, like, if we didn't have the Ish Kodesh, if we didn't have this like wild story of him publishing things and hiding it and it'd be found later, and right, would we have known about the Chovas HaTalmidim? Were there other things that he did over, like, what would have been had the Holocaust not happened? Or what contributions does he have beyond this specific story that took place during the Holocaust? So that's what I was trying to discover a little bit about, and I try to present a little bit over the next 10-15 minutes, and then we'll get back into a little bit about what happens in the Eish Kodesh, meaning what is the reading that one could take. Again, much is taken from this book, Chassidim, Suffering and Renewal, and then there's another book that was put together by Henry Abramson, which entirely is about 150 pages or so, is entirely available online. It could be very worthwhile reading over the next couple of days if you want to track it down and publish it. Henry Abramson is he's a professor of history at Turo. I came across him because he does the history of the DAF, that on the OU All DAF app. So he does like a 2 or 3 minute history lesson on every DAF, meaning something like what are these coins, like why is this significant, so that kind of thing. So he's certainly an interesting person. So again, his father was he was born in 1889. His father was the Imre Elimelech. That was the sefer named from Rav Elimelech of Luzhensk. His father passed away when he was very young, when he was like 3 or 4. He had recollections of saying Kaddish for his father when his father passed away, right? 3-year-old isn't going to remember much, but he seemed to remember that. He became Rav in Piasetzna, I'm not really sure exactly how to pronounce it, I've heard it pronounced in several different ways, but this town called Piasetzna in the year 1911. Now, 1911 is not much after 1889. I mean, he was 22 years old at the time. Piasetzna was not far from Warsaw. It looks like it's about 10 miles or so south of Warsaw. In the book here, it says that it wasn't necessarily the most chashuv place. Piasetzna was quickly replacing Chelm, or Chelm, I think, was in Lithuania. I think Piasetzna was in Poland, so it was the Chelm of Poland. It was sort of the reputation of the town was somewhat backwards, and even the reputation of some of the Rabbanim there was somewhat backwards. A small town. At that time, seems like it had about 3,000 people in it in total. Probably 35-40% of it was Jewish. And he was not the only rabbi there. There were several people sort of vying for this position. And a couple of years later is when he officially was offered the Ksav Rabbanus and became the Rav of Piasetzna, and also like the Rebbe of Piasetzna. So that gets you to around 1914-1915. What happens soon after that is 1914 is when World War I started. Is that like the someplace in that, right? So 1940, World War I started, and all of these and things became people had to leave, people were exiled, people, you know, we don't you don't really think about the Jewish role in World War One. You know, in the yeshiva world, though, the Lithuanian yeshivas got exiled into Russia. There was a lot of upheaval. And it was after that, after World War One, that many of these outlying communities that were prominent for having Hasidish rebbes moved towards larger cities. I think in the past we talked about the Munkacher Rav and how the Minchas Elazar was the prominent, but his son-in-law who took over for him had eyes towards moving the Hasidus or the seat of the Hasidus to Budapest. But plenty of rebbes moved their Hasidus, so to speak, to Warsaw, which is interesting, meaning which kind of like sets up a situation like Borough Park today, where you go to Borough Park. So Borough Park, there's large Hasid, you know, there's a large Bubov is probably the largest Hasidus in Borough Park, and then there's the Munkach is also relatively large, and then there's others. So you go down various streets. I remember on my grandparents' block at the corner was the Shtibel, the Hasidei Chernobyl. It was just like a little storefront on the corner of their block. And next door to my grandfather, this is already later on, but there was a Rebbe who moved in there and sort of set up the basement as his own shtiebel. So all of a sudden, this wasn't just an American thing. I kind of always thought about it as being an American thing. But this was already happening in Europe, that many of the Rebbes in outlying towns were sort of moving themselves to the large cities. Why were they doing that? So some of it had to do with that's where the people were, meaning a lot of people also were leaving the city, the towns in order to go to the cities during that time. First of all, Jews were, I guess, a little bit more welcomed in cities during that time. And it was considered to be safer. In the shtetls, you were more subject to pogroms, you were more subject to bombings and things like that. It was considered probably in the city there's at least some semblance of fairness and safety and security that the Jewish people would be able to claim. So a lot of them moved to Warsaw, and therefore the Rebbes moved as well. Now, nobody would be able to claim the mantle of being the Warsaw Rebbe, right? That's not a thing. I don't think everybody ever heard of the Warsaw Rebbe, because there wasn't one. But they went and sort of set up themselves as that. So in this book, one of the articles, it says that it's hard to give a number on how many Hasidim there were during that time, but he was able to find in Eastern Europe some kind of list of 6,500 shtiblach. Now those shtiblach were then all aligned with a certain Rebbe. So the Babavar Hasidim might have had several hundred shtiblach that sort of aligned themselves with the Babavar Hasidim. Same thing with the Ger Hasidim. Ger Hasidim was massive at the time. And also the town of Ger was also pretty close to Warsaw, I think a little bit to the east. So there were many thousands of people associated with them, and there are apparently five or six that were associated with the Piasetzner Rebbe. And he himself really moved to Warsaw. He really lived in Warsaw and sort of went out to Piasetzna every once in a while to hold Shabbos or to give chizuk and things like that. But after World War One, in 1918 or so, 1919 until he passed away, he really lived mostly in Warsaw, but was known as the Piasetzner Rebbe, as many Rebbes did. Many Rebbes lived in Warsaw and were known as this. Now, when you get yourself into that situation, there is now all of a sudden a competition that takes over, meaning you're not just the Rebbe in town, you're now sort of competing with others for Hasidim, and Hasidim could, They could go wherever they want. They could daven with whatever they want to do. So they may have had some kind of family allegiance with one type of Hasidus, but may have ended up other places. So it becomes it's obviously more of a Hefkervelt in Warsaw itself. But therefore you also perhaps need something to separate oneself. So what did he do? So he, Rav Shapiro, he founded a yeshiva, and a pretty significant yeshiva. The Das is known as Das Moshe. It was founded in 1923. And contrary to the Shlomo Karlach story, which maybe we'll get to at the end, the Das Moshe yeshiva was founded in it was in Warsaw, and it had several hundred Talmidim, which is a pretty large, I mean, the idea of the Hasidic yeshiva did not really exist in a large way until you get to that period. The yeshivas we know about were mostly in Lithuania. Poland, it seems like, was still going with the old cheder style and maybe sending Talmidim to other places, to Lithuania, if they were really considered to be sharp. But the idea of a Hasidic yeshiva did not really exist until you get to that point. And Rav Shapiro actually seems to be pretty progressive in terms of his educational style. A few things that, in a way, we take for granted today, which were not to be taken for granted during that era. So, for example, it's unclear to me how difficult it was to get into his yeshiva. I'm not sure it was difficult at all. I mean, to get into Slobodka, to get into the famous yeshivas of Lithuania, so we hear these stories of pin tests and that you had to know several hundred dafim before you started. His yeshiva was, A, for younger people. It sounds like it was what we would call grade school through some of high school. And I don't get the sense that it was this difficult place to go into. He was not necessarily training. I mean, the view of most yeshivas then was that we are training the next Gedolei Hador, and to the effect that it was a what's the term I'm looking for? That it was some kind of populist idea that it was like for everybody. It was really as well, we need, in order to be able to survive during this time, you have to be a massive Katam Chacham. So therefore, you know, you have to be bright, and it was all about the knowledge that you were going to attain. He they document this in this book. When he presented, they have a record, not a recording, but a printout of a speech that he gave at a dinner, a donor dinner. He spoke about the concept of, give us your children and we'll return them as Yirei Shamayim and Bnei Torah. Not we're going to return them as Gedolei Hador, and we're going to return them as Iluyim, and we're going to return them as Biki Bishas, but we're going to return them as Yirei Shamayim, and we're going to return them as Bnei Torah, those that are able to continue on and live Jewish lives going forward. So that's really, if you would think about yeshivas today, that's the presentation that is made today. Right, you know, right. Besifta of Greater Philadelphia is not making presentations to to parents of send us your kid and we'll turn him into the Gadol Hador. They're making presentations as we're going to turn them and prepare them to live a life as Balabat, as Bnei Torah, Balabatim, people that can work and people that can learn, people that can continue on. Our Masorah, not necessarily as Rabbanim, but as professionals, as Bnei Torah that are professionals. So I'm not sure you could date that much before Rav Shapiro. I don't know enough about the time to say that it was his chiddush, that it was his idea, but it was certainly not the way things were around the world at that time. It certainly was not the accepted view. Another thing that he added, and here we can go back to the source sheet at the back of the page, and that is sort of his approach as to what Hasidus is and what the purpose of Talmud Torah is. Now this again is not going to seem that much of a chiddush to us, but it was not the way things were understood back then. You know, it's not so long ago. This is about 100 years ago that Chovas HaTamidim was printed, but it was a new idea. I just add a little bit of background that I came across. I didn't also never really appreciate it until reading. And that is if we think about Hasidus pre-Rav Shapiro, the 19th century Hasidus, when it was really growing and when it was most appearing in the shtetlach, and sort of that view that we have of the, you know, of the Rebbe and the small town and the tales of the Hasidim, right? So what do we envision? So we often envision the Rebbe as being some sort of miracle worker, right? That you go to the Rebbe and he would, he would be able to do something to be able to save you. We don't really see him as the Torah leader. That's not completely true. It was sort of a split along those lines. There were some who were in that realm of being the miracle worker, and there were others that were more in the learning mode. So if we think about the Lubavitcher Rebbes during that time, while there are certainly stories of miracles that are told by them, they mostly were in the learning mode. Or if we think about people like the Kutzker Rebbe, or the Another that I'm thinking of that's eluding me right now. But there is a learning group, and then there is sort of like the miracle worker group. So Rav Shapiro, his lineage puts himself in the miracle worker group. The Rupshitz, the Rav Elimelech, Limi Lezhensk, as you mentioned before, that line is a miracle line. I mean, he had forefathers who were able to do this kind of stuff. But that's not what his focus on. His focus was as a teacher, as a malamed, as one who would teach Torah. So his sefer, Chuvas HaTamidim, so we just read a little bit here on page 22. This is from the introduction. He says, "V'zeh ikar b'Torah sachasis shlo yistapik ha'ish b'sichlo levad asher koveya ba'avoda ki ha'iskashus asher b'sichel levad." That the main part about chasidus is a person should not limit himself to connections to the Torah just by way of his seichel. Anything that is just through his seichel, ki is kashrus sher b'seichel levad, in a kesher shel kayama, right? That's not going to be something, a connection to Torah that's going to last. Yachol hu l'shabdo v'ladas barer b'sichlo shirakes Hashem tzarechu lava b'chol prate machshava diburu ma'isa shelo. V'mikol makom ligo v'chol gufo l'rechokim. Meaning he could then have clear all of the halacha, but yet his heart and his body could be very distant from it. As kol nafshu v'chiyas gufo tzarechu liskasher. But you really need to connect your whole body to your whole life needs to be connected to Torah. So tzarech lachto des nafshu la'alosa ula'orva she'islai v'chol mitzvus b'torah v'tfila tis'aneg ba'oneg ruchani v'tismachba. And therefore you'll be able to do all of the mitzvos that you do and all of the Torah and all of your davening and everything that you do, you'll be able to get much joy from all of these mitzvos. So again, I think that's something that I don't think we're shocked by hearing this type of thing, but it's also not something that you necessarily saw much earlier than that. The idea that that we're trying to get the chiyas, we're trying to get life from all of the mitzvos that we do, not just be able to do things by rote or be able to do things academically. Similarly, on the left side of the page, page 122, so here he says, "Uv emes imi," his approach to learning as well. He says, "Uv emes im yish davar kal b'Torah l'mashal keshehitchilu gemara lomod gemara lamdum chaberishonim b'vav metziyah shtaim ochsim shehu kal liyelad." Right, the first thing that a person learns when they're in Gemara is traditionally the beginning of vav metziyah shnayim ochsim betalas. My other grandfather, my mother's father, who grew up in Warsaw and then moved to Frankfurt, I think, when he was 11 or 12 years old. So he still recalls being in Cheder, and he would still be able to say that first Mishnah, Bal Pesh, Naim Ochsim Betalis, and say in his, Polish that became German accent. He'd still be able to recall that first Mishnah. So Rav Shapiro continues on and says, Shnayim Ochsim Betalis, Kal Yelid, Ve'im, it might be easy, it might seem easy, but then think about how much work was put into it by all of the Rishonim and all of the Achronim and all the commentators that worked on it. And when you be able to understand the more, you'll be able to see more. By looking and investigating and understanding more, so you'll be able to be connected and be able to become much tighter and closer with the Torah, and you'll be able to gain a lot from it as well. So, right, again, the idea that every individual has the ability to learn at some level and be able to investigate and be able to get deeper into Torah is in a way something that has become the regular Musar Shmuz that you hear in most yeshivas today, right? Everybody has their connection that they're supposed to have to the Torah. But yet, I'm not sure it was that common during this era, and in some ways was mechadish from Rav Shapiro. Okay, so that sort of gets us to gets us to the 20s and to the 30s, and that sort of then gets us to the period of being in the ghetto. So I'm not going to speak about what life was like in the ghetto. There's other places. In fact, this past week in the Headlines podcast, had several fascinating interviews. In fact, one of them with my roommate / chavrusa, Rabbi Brand, who's now the Rosh Kollel in Chicago, who also has a shiur. If you want to, recently, I think last week, I listened to it also this morning while running. So he also has a shiur on Rav Shapiro. So they did regarding the issue of fighting the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. I mean, what was the Torah approach to the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising? I mean, some were Rabbanim were for, some were against. Much of it focused around Rav Menachem Zemba, who's also somebody that I've wanted to do in one of these classes, but just haven't been able to find enough information. Although maybe now some more might be available. So there is more discussion about what life was like in the ghetto and the dates and what went into the decision to attempt to fight back, but. Obviously, things were very difficult, and you had Hasidim who really didn't know what was going to be. They were all living together, and there was much suffering and a lot of death that was around them. I would just add that the Rebbe himself, his wife and children, I think two children, perished, I think, before the war. I mean, I think he has a son that got injured, very gravely injured, during a bombing. When the Germans invaded, right, so the first thing was the Blitzkrieg, which started with a bombing. So I think he has a son that got mortally wounded in this bombing, and then he was in the hospital, and then the hospital was bombed. While I think he wasn't there, but his wife and other kids were there, I think that much of his family perished in that bombing. So in a way, he was by himself. I don't think his wife was alive during this time. So he was by himself, but his address was, his door was open. People were coming to him constantly. He didn't just know religious people. There's connections that he had with the non-religious people in the area as well. And again, he was and he sort of continued to run this. Unclear to me whether he ran the yeshiva. He certainly had talmidim while in the ghetto, meaning he still continued to teach and have students there. I don't know if it was officially under the auspices of his of his yeshiva or whether it was something else, but he was definitely a very prominent person in the ghetto. Now, as you mentioned before, and I want to get into a little bit about some of the things you could see in the Sefer in the Eish Kodesh or in the drushes that he has. So there wasn't a connection. He doesn't allude to any time to specific events that took place that week. So that had led some historians to sort of like dismiss it as, okay, it's a, it's Torah, but like we're historians, we're looking for history, we're not necessarily looking for Divrei Torah. But there were some, and then Dr. Henry Abramson sort of took this to the next level, said, wait a second, if you go to a regular shul on Shabbos, so often the rabbi is alluding to current events, he's just not often mentioning it explicitly, meaning I think I myself will sometimes allude to things that are certainly happening in current events while not necessarily saying clearly that this is what I'm alluding to, but I'm even Yavin, those that understand are able to understand. So certainly a Rebbe who's speaking, so he's not going to allude necessarily to things that happened right then, but he could, but certainly in his drashas, he would be able to, if you figure out what was happening in the ghetto at that time, and then you look at his drashos, you might be able to see some connections that what he was speaking to were reactions to things that were taking place. Now, I'm not one of these people that have read through the entire Eish Kodesh from cover beginning to end and can necessarily make these claims, but Dr. Abramson in his article gives a couple of examples, and those are, if he's using those examples, those are probably the most obvious examples, but I'll show you some of the things that he points out. One is here, so all the drushos are dated by parsha, year, and date, and you see here, so Metzora 1940, Parshas Metzora 1940. So he's dealing here with the issue of the question that he raises based on Rashi is that, the halacha is when it comes to a Metzora that we require a Kohen to label it as being a Metzora. right? And a Talmud Chacham is not able to. In fact, a Talmud Chacham might very well know the halachos and might know exactly what it is, but the Talmud Chacham is not able to declare it, to declare it as such. In addition to that, he says that the there is the Medrash that discusses that if you if a house ever gets destroyed because of tzaras, so yeah, you might have to destroy the house, but a treasure is going to be found underneath. And he asks the question, why is it that there needs to be that delay? I mean, you have to the house needs to be you find the spot. The Kohen goes and says, ah, Taka, you have the spot that is a tzaras spot. The house is then cut off. You're not allowed to go into the house for a week. And then you come back, and if the spot got bigger, so then that's that means that the house has been is Saras house. I think there might be one more cycle, I forget. And then the house needs to be destroyed. And if the but we're promised that if the house is destroyed in that way, you'll be able to find a treasure underneath. So why do you need that? Why do you need that wait? If Hashem wants to give a treasure, let him give a treasure. So these are this is the Torah he's discussing in this drasha. And he concludes, he says, therefore it's explicitly taught in the Torah that even though the leprous mark on the houses was tamei and could make a person tamei, God still made of it an instrument for the good of the Jewish people. For it was tamei for 7 days, and only then was the treasure revealed. And so the law states, a person must say, it looks to me as if there is something like a mark on the house. Even if he's a Talmid Chacham, knows what it is. He only says it's like a mark. For as we said above, a person is never really able to tell whether what is happening to him is a curse or an event. All he can say is that it looks like a curse. The truth, however, as the Torah announces, is that God is doing with us is for the good of Israel. Right. So this is in a way a classic drasha. Right. He's looking and say, he's saying that what's the message that you get from this mitzvah? That things might look really bad and it might look like you need to destroy the house. But ultimately, right, it will lead to a treasure at the end. And therefore, Talmud Chacham says it looks like a mark because he doesn't really know what it is. I mean, he knows what it is. They're saying we don't really know what the future has in told. It could be that this is what's going to lead you to great brachas. Even things that look difficult could ultimately lead to bracha. So taken in context, that's normal, right? That we would expect to say. So Dr. Abramson shows that what was going on that week. That week was the week that the walls actually started going up around the ghetto, meaning there was a period of time when they were all gathered in the place and walls were not built yet. They knew of other places where there were walls, and there weren't walls there. The Jews all had to be connected in this area. And then the walls started going up that week. And and there was a lot of fear, right? People were getting very, very afraid. So as a response to that, the rabbi's drasha that week was, yeah, things look very, very bad, but how are we to know what's really bad? Maybe this is ultimately what's going to lead us to bracha at the end. And you can imagine being a chassid, hearing that and saying like, oh, okay, like that gives chias, that gives some encouragement and perhaps allows one to be able to continue. Similarly, right under it, I have here, right, Shlach 1940. Go to the bottom right. Get to the Chanukah one and Ekev. That's a different issue. But Shlach 1940 is also a standard drasha, right? This is, you can see, Parsha Shlach. We're going to go forth and we're going to occupy. That's what Kalev said, right? At the end, the spies come. The spies say, "Oh yeah, yeah, things are terrible. We're not going to be able to be successful at all." And Kalev comes, "Oh, we're going to go ahead and be successful, right?" And he right. And this drasha happens to be three paragraphs. That's the whole thing. Most of them are two, three, four pages in this book in English. And this is two thirds of it. I just didn't have room to give you the last third. But he says, "Let's attempt to understand what's going on. If the spies spoke with reason, right there, right? Kalev should have debated them, right? Kalev doesn't give them an answer. The spies are saying the people are big and the people are strong and we're so tiny and they're organized and we're not and they're fortified and how are we going to buy, right? And Kalev says, we're going to go and be successful. Well, shouldn't Kalev at least give a reason as to why he thinks he'll be able to be successful? Why are they not? So therefore, he says this is how a Jew must be. Not only when he is reason, sees reasonable openings and paths for salvation to take within the law of nature, must have the faith in Hashem will save him, but even when we don't really see a way that we're going to be able to be saved, still we have to have emunah, we still have to have faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that we're going to be able to be, that we're going to be able to be saved. So again, classic drasha. Certainly, you know, there is no lacking of difficult things that were going on during that time, and you could see why it would make sense in that period. Dr. Abram says that something very significant happened that week of Parsha Shlach 1940, and that is the Nazis had reached really the peak of their power that week. That was the week, apparently, that Paris fell, and they were able to stretch essentially all the way to the English Channel. So that was the height of German power was that week. And the Jews are saying, oh, like, how are we ever going to be able to ever be successful? You know, like, how's this ever going to end? It's never going to end. They're going to win and all that. And therefore he comes back and says, no, we're, you know, like Kalev said, Kalev didn't have to give a reason. Kalev said, you'll see, we'll be successful. Let's, you know, don't lose faith. Things are going to be okay. But That was his. So again, while it looks like a standard drasha that a Rav would give, when connected with events that were happening at the time, which you could find out from other sources what those events were, you understand a little bit more how the Rebbe was speaking to his chassidim. So as you mentioned before, that's what you really see throughout the Sefer of Eish Kodesh. Now, as you mentioned before, so this continued 1941. 1942, early 1942 is when they really start to understand that what the plans were. The plans were not that we're just going to leave them and the Jews, you know, they'll be secluded here for this area, but that there is a final solution that was being planned. Now, I would just add, part of what the Rebbe was teaching, and this is a theme really that you see throughout, is that the Jews have always gone through trouble, and we've always been able to survive. Right? That v'chol dever dor omdim aleinu l'chaotzein v'kadosh baruch hu matzilein miyadam. Right? In every generation they tried to kill us, and Hashem was able to succeed. And this is like every other generation. Other generations have suffered, and this generation is suffering as well. The change that takes place in early 1942 is that he starts realizing that this is really beyond what others had suffered, and the tone shifts from, you know, we have to re-energize and prepare for after the war when we're gonna, you know, we're gonna re-energize ourselves and rebuild that which was lost, so etc., to somewhat of an acceptance of things are really bad and we have to really prepare perhaps to dial Kiddush Hashem. And that then leads to the summer. Again, we don't really, the drushes of that summer are sort of become scant. I mean, the time that the transports are taking place, we don't really have much from him already at that point. He's already at that point seems to be focusing on looking at what's been done and sort of preparing it for printing eventually. And there are a couple of, and so notes that he adds in, so he adds in notes throughout to sort of, you know, that editorial notes that he changes. And then there's two places in Eish Kodesh, at least two that I know of, that he, where he puts in a long note and wants you to know that, you know, that clearly demonstrates that things are different. And both of them, he actually gives a date when it was added. So if you take a look at the top left, so sort of Hanukkah 1941. So 1941, again, classic. What excuse does a person have to question Hashem and his faith damaged by this prevailing suffering more than Jews who went through suffering in bygone times? Why should a person's faith become damaged now? It was not damaged when he read descriptions of Jewish suffering from antiquity to the present, right? You don't have problems of emunah from reading the Gemara where it talks about difficult times. So this is also a difficult time, right? Those who say that suffering such as this had never befallen us, there was torture comparable to ours at the destruction of the temple and Beitar, etc. May Hashem have mercy and end our suffering, and he could save us now immediately forever. So that's 1941 saying, right, like we just said, things are like they've always been. So he adds a note on the bottom, however, that says this note was added. You can see the date that he added. Note added by the author on November 27th, 1942. Right. So this is after the the ghetto has been mostly emptied. And he says, only such torment as was endured until the middle of 1942 has ever transpired previously in history. The bizarre tortures and freakish, brutish murders that have been invented for us by the depraved, perverted murderers solely for the suffering of Israel since the middle of 1942, meaning since the trains started coming, are, according to my knowledge and the words of our sages and of the chronicles of Jewish people in general, unprecedented and unparalleled. May Hashem have mercy upon us and save us from their hand. The horrifying, in the blink of an eye. All right, so there is an acceptance that things are different, that things are not really the same. And we can't just say, oh, this is another terrible episode in the history of our people. And he says a similar thing here in Akev 1941. So, and there he says as well, true, on the left is the original drasha, true at the time when every head is sick and every heart is breaking, is difficult to study your prayers. On the other hand, it must be admitted, there are people today who make too much of these troubles, doing nothing but wasting time and words all day. Is it too much to demand that they use this spare time to learn things? Meaning, you have time, so learn. Yeah, I know things are hard. I know you're starving. I know you don't have food. I know you're sick. I know, yeah, but okay, but fine. So you still should attempt to learn. So here he adds a note as well. The above was said and written in 1941. Then, however, bitter were the troubles of suffering was apparent from the text above. It was at least possible to lament, to find words to describe the handful of events, to worry about the survivors, and grieve for the future. How will they rebuild the schools and yeshivas? Right, we still had the wherewithal to admonish, right, to give mussar, inspire those, right, with the desire for Torah and worship. This is no longer a case. It's the end of 1942, when the Holy Congregation has been annihilated in a radical excision. Those individuals who survive, pitiful and few, are broken in slavery and Egyptian bondage, downtrodden and terrified for their lives. There exist no words for which to lament our woes. There is no one to admonish, and there is no heart to awaken to worship the Torah. How many trials must one undergo at the price of prayer, and how many tests must one withstand just to observe Shabbos, even for those who generally long to observe it? There is certainly no spirit or heart left to grieve for the future holds, or to plan reconstruction or the destroyed edifices at such time that God has mercy on us and save us. Only God, He will have mercy and save us in the blink of an eye. It's the rebuilding of all that has been destroyed that will only happen with Mashiach and Tchias HaMesim. God alone can rebuild. Please Hashem have mercy and don't delay. So this is the bitterest, right? This is added in 1943. So this is probably the last thing that he added in, with the realization that this was a terrible, this is unprecedented in human history. And, you know, again, he's not getting the newspaper every day. He doesn't know, but he knows that things are that this is beyond anything that has existed before. This is to the point that there are some who have even suggested that he lost emunah at this point. I personally, just from reading it, find that hard to believe. Meaning, he was also writing this though for it to survive. Right, he was not writing this for it to be an academic thing that's going to be found one day by some other civilization. He did write down in his last note saying that I want this to be sent to my brother in Eretz Yisrael, who's going to publish it, and with a plea for it to be published. So I find that hard to believe that he had any, you know, significant drop of emunah, as depressing as this paragraph might be. But that then gets you to the end of that sort of gets you to the end of the period in the ghetto. Two more things. Number one is he himself was taken in early 1943, again, to the Tranicki camp. It seems at some point there was actually an effort made to free him, that he was offered freedom in some way or another, unclear, at least to be freed from this labor camp that he was in. He was offered that. He turned it down because apparently he had made a pact with other members of his group saying that, you know, we're not leaving, no one leaves until all of us leave, or something along those lines. So he actually did not leave, which is pretty wild, meaning at this point he no longer has his children, he no longer has family, no longer has his chassidim, he's got nothing. But yet he still found the necessity to sort of stay with his flock. He was able to, what happened was, I'm not sure what the, at some point, I think actually early on, meaning the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising happened in Pesach time, 1943. I think soon after that, there was also a bombing at Treblinka. They were able to, you may have come across this story. There was was somehow they were able to somehow smuggle in some type of bomb equipment into Treblinka and was able to blow up, I think, either the railroad station, the railroad car. It made it difficult to use Treblinka. And then there was another camp also that they were able, and these were all Warsaw Jews that were able to do this. So I think in Treblinka they said, we don't want anyone more from Warsaw. So they sent them instead to Majdanek or to some other places. Majdanek, my grandmother actually was in Majdanek. Rivka, my daughter Ricky, Rivka Gross, so that, you know, before she was Rivka Gross, was in Majdanek. Majdanek was a work and death camp. So if there are survivors from the Warsaw Ghetto, it probably means that they were sent to Majdanek or to this place Troniki. However, there weren't too many survivors from there either, because in October or November of 1943, there was something called Operation Harvest Festival. I don't know, maybe some have heard of this, where apparently they, because the Germans were had come across these various bombings, the uprising and the two bombings in the camp, they said, you know, we just got to start killing as many as we can. And apparently from those places in that region, they killed about 40,000 Jews on that day, November 3rd, 1943, which was, I read, was the largest single-day massacre total of the entire war. And that is the assumption. I'm not sure we know for sure, but the assumption is that Rav Shapiro was one of those that was shot on that day. November 3rd, 1943, his yurtzeit is recognized as Hei Mar Cheshvan, Hei Tufshin Dalid. And that is the day that has been continuously observed as being his yahrzeit. I'll just share one more thing, and it might make sense. I found that it's on YouTube. You could listen to it yourself. But there is a famous Rav Shlomo Carlbach story, one of his greatest, that he the story of the Holy Hunchback. If you've come across the Holy Hunchback, so he tells the story that he was once in Tel Aviv, and he was down the street, and he says on the recording that, you know, sometimes Hashem gives everybody a little bit of prophecy, and something told me that I should go and say hello to this yid. So he goes, and there was a man there who was sweeping the boardwalk in Tel Aviv, and he realizes that he's a hunchback, Shlomo Carlbach sort of taps him on the shoulder and says, you know, Reb Yid, shalom, to which the person responds saying, aloichem shalom, meaning the Hasidish thing. So Carlbach said, I realized that he must be, I said, you know, you come from Poland. He said, yes. Where do you come from? So he says, from Piasecna. And he says, really, did you? I've been waiting my whole life to meet somebody who met the holy Rav Kolonovitz Kalman Shapiro. Can you, you know, what did you ever meet him? Did you ever meet the holy tzaddik? To which he says, you know, did I never meet him? I learnt in his yeshiva. So just so you know, it's a little, that the historicity is a little questionable, because as you said before, the yeshiva wasn't in Piasecna, it was in Warsaw. But anyways, it could be that he did, it could be that he learned in like the cheder in Piasecna, where the Rebbe came to visit once in a while. But either way, so Karbach says to him, can you tell me a teaching? He says, are you kidding? You want to tell me? I should tell you a teaching. I was taken to Auschwitz at the age of 11. And because I was pretty, I was a big person, I was very big, they thought I was older. They thought I was 17, and they worked me for 5 years, which again is a little difficult to hear I would be for that long, but whatever, that's how Karlov says it. You know, they worked me and they beat me, and that's why I'm deformed the way that I am. But I don't remember anything from the Holy Tzaddik. So he says, come on, you must remember something. And Carlos says to him, if you tell me, whatever teaching you tell me, I will make sure it gets publicized mamish to the entire world. So he says, okay, I'll tell you something. And the way he records stories, he was a Hasidish Yid. So he goes, he says, hold on. He walks over to his locker on the side and opens his locker, and he takes out his hat and puts a gartel, like puts his jacket on to say, you know, about to say over Torah from the Rebbe, I have to get dressed in order to do so. And he says, you know, he gives a whole description about what Friday night was like in the yeshiva, where there are hundreds and thousands of students. Again, historically, how exactly accurate that it is a little unclear, but he records what he says. You know, we danced. You can imagine how many, you know, the children all dancing with the Rebbe, and we used to eat together on Friday night, and he used to say Divrei Torah, you know, after the challah and before the fish, and then after the fish before the soup, and after the soup before the meat, and after the meat before dessert. He said Divrei Torah at every one of those turns, and at the end of the Torah he would say, you might not remember any of my Torah, but he concluded by saying, Tyre Hayra Kinderlach, you should remember my holy, my special children, Gedenst Schoen, right? Remember, the greste Sache in the Welt, zu tumit emitzen a teufa. He says the most important thing in the world is to do a Jew a favor. And this this Yid continues and tells Rishonmo, he says, that's what I remember, that he told us the most important thing in the world is to do a Jew a favor. And he says, you know, my family was destroyed, I lost everybody, and I was taken to Auschwitz, and there were several times when I just said, I'm going to give up, I'm going to go, and I'll throw myself against the barbed wire or something, and end it. And as I'm walking to do so, I hear the Rebbe's voice in my head saying, you know, Tyre Yidden, remember, like the most important thing in the world is to be able to help a Jew. And on one hand, he's saying, how can you help a Jew? You're in the middle of Auschwitz. But then he says, you realize how many favors you could do for a Jew in Auschwitz? Right? And I went back to the bunk and I saw there was someone sitting in the corner and everybody had their story and everybody had their complaints and there's nobody to listen to any of their complaints. And I sat down next to this person and said, you know, tell me what's wrong. And the person just unloads and talks to him the entire night. And therefore I was able to do him a favor. He says, and then I came here to Israel. And even in Israel, I still don't have no family. I'm still deformed. I still don't, you know, I have a couple of pennies that I get from sweeping the streets here in Tel Aviv. But other than that, I got nothing. And there were times I just walked into, the way he describes it, I walked into the ocean thinking like I was just going to end it. And as I walked in, I said to myself, I heard the voice in my head saying, you know, Tyre Yidden, Kinderlach, remember, the most important thing in the world is to do a Jew a favor. You know how many favors there are to do here? So I went to the bus station. I found some Yid sitting on the floor that had nothing. And I said, you know, tell me your story. And the person was able to tell my story. And that's what gave me the chizuk to be able to live on. So that is the story of Rav Shapiro. His name continues to live on, much to the efforts of people like Moshe Weinberger. I think there's two other shuls also in the country that go by the name Eish Kodesh that are named after him. And certainly, I remember when I was in yeshiva, I never read through it from beginning to end, but his Chovas HaTamidim was standard. A lot of guys read through that, sort of what we would call a unique approach that has almost become the standard approach, Bizman HaZeh. But ultimately, he will be remembered most for his being the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto, for being the Rebbe of the, as he called, the years of rage, the years of complaint, hopefully his, as this Yid concludes by saying, there'll never be another Shabbos like that until the coming of Mashiach. And hopefully we'll be able to use his zechusim, use his marriage to be able to attain that day. Here your name. Okay, so thank you everybody for staying. I realized it went a little long. I didn't realize how late it was until a minute or two ago. But